You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Queen Mother by A. Kirsten Mullen. An organizational zealot, Moore was a member of the Communist, Republican, and Democratic parties, as well as, she said, the Elks and the Masons. She was a Catholic, an ordained bishop, and a convert to the Baptist and Ethiopian Orthodox communities of faith and the Apostolic Orthodox Church of Judah. "I've got all the religions," she said years later. "I have one objective, win 'em for freedom." One might wonder if she ever worked for the FBI, which built a copious file on Moore over a 20-year period. Apparently, the agency did approach her in the 1940s to become an informant. Her account of what took place, "I'll tell you the truth. When I am in my right mind, I could join the Ku Klux Klan and know why I'm there, you understand? I could join the police force if I had to." In 1919, during the Red Summer, white terrorists launched upwards of 40 attacks on black communities. The heroic military service of more than 380,000 blacks during World War I had not brought an end to disenfranchisement and segregation, debt peonage, and racial violence. White supremacy at home proved to be a more invincible foe than the German army. Blacks in Louisiana and elsewhere were desperate to see an end to the carnage and the destruction of black property, but they did not have the capacity to make this happen. Marcus Garvey believed the solution lay with blacks themselves. Like his hero, Booker T. Washington, he embraced respectability politics. Blacks must accept responsibility for improving themselves to show white Americans they are worthy of equal rights. First, though, they must accept and celebrate their African past and be proud of their black skin. The next year, 1920, Garvey was scheduled to speak in New Orleans, but was arrested. When he was released the following day, he returned to the Longshoremen Hall to bring his message of Africa for Africans and back to Africa, the place where all black people could be proud, unified, and self-sufficient. The police, on alert to arrest him again at the least provocation, had not counted on the crowd arriving armed to the teeth, ready to defend Garvey, Moore, and her family among them. The police withdrew. The Moores briefly contemplated moving to Africa, but decided to relocate to Harlem instead. First, they took a month-long trip to Los Angeles, where Moore met several women in what was called Black Society, who took her to Santa Monica, where they wanted to charge us $5 for a bottle of 5-cent soda. She became disillusioned until all the people there said, "Oh, my dear, if it's freedom you're looking for, we could have told you. We have discrimination in California. Where you should have gone was Chicago." So the Moores traveled to Chicago, where they found conditions worse than in New Orleans. "Oh," they said, "my dear, it's not here. Harlem's where you need to go." Now, I didn't realize Harlem, too, was Jim Crow. No blacks were hired as bus or streetcar drivers, and no one could find a job in their own neighborhood. Black women stood on the street corners, and the Jewish women used to come, almost just like slavery days, feel their muscles, look at their knees to see if they had crust on their knees, evidence that they could get on their knees to wax their floors, she recalled years later. That was when Moore committed herself to the movement. After Garvey was indicted on mail fraud charges in 1922 and deported to Jamaica in 1927, Moore turned her attention to the work that would lead to what historian Ashley D. Farmer, who is writing a biography of Moore, calls her pioneering role in forging the modern reparations movement. With the support of her sister Eloise, whom Moore called the family Socrates, brilliant, analytical, she began to organize her neighbors in their mutual struggle for survival and decency. Throughout the Great Depression, Moore and her fellow reformers were engaged in great struggle. Already relegated to the lowest-paying professions, blacks experienced an unemployment rate of approximately 50% in 1932 New York. When the U.S. Communist Party made the unlikely decision to champion the cause of the Scottsboro Boys, 9 black youths who had been falsely accused of raping 2 white women in Alabama, Moore eagerly offered her services. She would serve the party as secretary of its Harlem section in 1941. And secretary of the New York State Party in 1942. Moore managed the successful campaign of New York City's first avowed black communist city council member, Benjamin Jefferson Davis, Jr., in 1943. In later years, Moore took pains to give the party its due for getting black doctors and nurses into hospitals. But there were problems. Apart from Harlem section head James W. Ford, whose grandfather had been lynched, burned alive, when Ford was young, and who was the party's vice presidential nominee in 1932, 1936, and 1940, the New York chapter leadership was Lily White. And while other national commissions were given the authority to meet separately, Italians, Jews, Romanians, Estonians, Finns, the Negro Commission had white members. When Moore realized they had no intention of working with blacks as equal partners, her admiration turned to frustration. She resigned in 1950, later recalling, "Racist by the score, racist, full of racism." Over this time, Mary McLeod Bethune had recruited Moore to the National Council of Negro Women, which had a reputation as a less militant organization. By 1944, Moore was a member of its executive board, working on integration and housing discrimination and defeating poll tax legislation. Moore made 10 trips to Europe in 1946 to escort war brides and their infants who had been left behind by American GIs to the U.S. During her nearly 2-year stint in the Army Civilian Corps, she worked for and escorted 7 to 8,000 brides of every nationality, except German, to America. In an interview she gave to the Chicago Defender in January 1947, Moore marveled at the women's lack of race prejudice, noting that one woman has married a Brooklyn GI, and already she knows that the Statue of Liberty means more to her than to me, a Negro, who brought her here. The 1950s seemed to be the decade of Moore's full flowering, the point where her vision expanded to a desire for freedom for Africans everywhere at home and abroad. In 1954, Moore's brother died, so she returned to Louisiana and was reunited with the Sons and Daughters of Ethiopia, which had grown out of Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. Several years later, she drew together her base in Louisiana and in her adopted home of Harlem to found the Universal, after Garvey's UNIA, Association of Ethiopian Women, with, among others, her sisters Eloise and Loretta, to decrease the number of executions of our youth on challenges of rape of white women. Moore viewed white supremacy, Jim Crow segregation and terror, political persecution, the oppression of black womanhood, colonialism, lynching, and black poverty as forms of genocide. These practices, she believed, represented a violation of universal, inalienable human freedoms, such as freedom of conscience, the right of self-determination protected under the United Nations Human Rights Declarations, and ultimately the right to life. In 1963, in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, Moore launched and led the Committee for Reparations for Descendants of U.S. Slaves. The group published her treatise, Why Reparations? Reparations is the battle cry for the economic and social freedom of more than 25 million descendants of American slaves. 5 years later, in 1968, she named co-founded and developed the concept for the Black Nationalist Republic of New Africa. Members demanded self-determination. Land, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and parts of Texas and Florida, and funding from the U.S. government. Mora was at the height of her powers during the decolonization of Africa and began to promote repatriation, making more than a dozen trips to the continent. In 1972, when she was invited to attend the Organization of African Unity, the old chief in Ghana sent for her so he could initiate me. The chief showered her with gobs of gold, jewels, bracelets of gold, rings and ropes of gold around my neck, and a crown. He got the stool and the umbrella and initiated me Queen Mother of the Ashanti. She would use her platform with the Philadelphia-based National Emancipation Proclamation Centennial Observation Committee to push this Africa for Africans agenda, one she would elaborate upon continuously until she died in 1997. In her later years, Moore consented to a 1978 life review with Cheryl Townsend Gilkes, conducted for the Black Women Oral History Project, and her son, Thomas O. Warner, whom she called her prince, wrote about his famous mother. Many of the atrocities Moore worked to address have not been eradicated. She would not be surprised to learn of the enormous suffering of Black Americans during the COVID pandemic. Nationwide, at this writing, 146,108 Blacks have died from COVID-19, a mortality rate 1.7 times that of whites and twice the rate of Asians. The Black mortality rate is 457 per 100,000. In November 2020, when the death rate peaked, Blacks and Hispanics and American Indians or Alaska Natives were nearly four times as likely to die from COVID as whites. What would these numbers have looked like if Black Americans had received repatriations, had received reparations before the onset of the virus in 2015, say, or 2010? In an experiment led by Eugene T. Richardson and James Holland Jones that was designed to look at racial justice interventions, scholars examined the social equity status of two disparate locations, South Korea and Louisiana, Moore's home state. They found there would have been a reduction in the ability of the disease to spread of 31% to 68%. That positive health effect would have been realized by Blacks and distributed across all racial groups, benefiting the population at large. In 1994, when she was 96 years old, Queen Mother Audley Moore addressed a conference in Detroit. "Reparations, reparations," the legend urged her audience. "Keep on, keep on. We've got to win." in search of lost time. 5 decades after Paul Newman's Rolex inspired a generation to hunt down vintage watches, Julian Sancton goes inside the frenzied elite market for the rarest timepieces in the world. Opening photo, about face, showing Paul Newman wearing his famous watch. Most current cosmographs run for $14,000 to $46,000. In 2017, Paul Newman's sold for $17.8 million. On the morning of December 11th, a young, nattily dressed, largely unmasked crowd streamed into the lower level of Phillips in Midtown Manhattan for the 2021 New York watch auction, abuzz with the kind of anticipation you might expect in line for a concert. Phillips' brand new glass box headquarters sits at the foot of 432 Park Avenue, the matchstick-thin luxury residential tower that teeters over a short stretch of Midtown, commonly known as Billionaire's Row, but that might as well be called the Watch District. On the same block are multi-level flagship stores for a number of coveted luxury watch brands, including Vacheron Constantin, Audemars Piguet, and Richard Mille, some of whose timepieces retail for seven figures. The auction-goers took their seats in the brightly lit white-walled room, iPhones at the ready, to document what promised to be a momentous event. Just a few days before the sale, well after catalogs had been printed and shipped to collectors around the world, Phillips had announced a surprise first lot. A new Patek Philippe reference 5711 Nautilus sports watch, made in partnership with Tiffany's, complete with a robin's egg dial. The watch's retail price was $52,635, spare change for the kind of big-game collector auction houses typically target. Earlier in the year, Patek Philippe, perhaps the ne plus ultra of luxury watchmakers, had sent the watch world into hysterics when it announced that it would discontinue the 5711, perhaps its most iconic model. The Tiffany's iteration would be among the last ever produced. Patek made just 170 of them, so unless you were one of Tiffany's 169 best customers, your only chance to buy one new was to bid on it this morning at Phillips. The star of the event, aside from the watch, was the elegantly grizzled man behind the rostrum, Arl Bach, whose company, Bach & Russo, has partnered with Phillips since 2014. Bach is as close to a celebrity as an auctioneer can get, having presided over numerous record-shattering watch sales during the last 20 years at three major houses. Born in Zurich in 1971, Bach had a flair for finding unique pieces and a genius for the coup de théâtre. In 2017, Christie's sold an ultra-rare watch previously owned by the Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie, and within 2 days, Bach stole their thunder with a Rolex that belonged to Vietnam's last emperor, Bao Dai. It sold for almost twice the price. His fondness for spectacle was on full display last December. Exuding a wolfish, Middle-European charm, Bach wielded his gavel like a baton, the room both his audience and his orchestra. Lot number one started off pianissimo. Bach opened the bidding at $20,000, less than half the retail price. Starting with such an unrealistically low bid is often designed to generate momentum before the real bidding begins. Crescendo, fielding bids from the dozens in attendance, as well as from phone banks and thousands of online participants, Bach effortlessly drove the price to six figures, then seven. His voice rising in intensity, he cajoled, teased, flattered, and prodded to coax the number ever higher. When bidding reached $4.9 million, Bach turned to the sole paddle raiser left in the room, a young man standing by the stairs in a white T-shirt and camel hair coat, smiled and said, "You know what my ambitions are here, right? Come on." To the delight of the crowd. When the laughter subsided, Bach let a tense silence reign. A Philips employee shouted $5 million on behalf of a phone bidder, and Bach belted out a flamboyant bravo, leading an exultant round of applause. Fortissimo. Several minutes later, the bidding having stalled at $5,150,000, Bach began to swing his gavel down with a flourish when a higher bid, made online from Miami, stopped at a few inches from the rostrum, interrupting Bach halfway through the word sold. Amid the hubbub, Bach wheezed and clutched his heart. The sale continued, as if bidders were as eager to keep watching the maestro as they were to win the watch. Bach's hammer came down. At last, 3 minutes later, the lot went to an unnamed online buyer in New York City who had bid $5,350,000, handily setting a new record for a Patek Philippe Nautilus. With fees and commissions, the buyer would end up paying $6.5 million, more than 100 times the retail price. Though the proceeds of lot number one went to the Nature Conservancy, the sale was nonetheless a marketing coup for Philips, Patek Philippe, and LVMH, which owns Tiffany's. 4 days later, Jay-Z, a Tiffany's brand ambassador, was photographed wearing one. Not long after, LeBron James showed off his own robin's egg Nautilus on Instagram. The watch would have sold high no matter what, but Bach's performance had turned it into a moment. That was auction theater at its finest, says a top watch industry insider. It was masterful in the way it was orchestrated. I think it was only when the final two bidders were going at it that we saw the real auction. In a dramatic twist, the transaction never went through. In late January, Philips executive Paul Boutros told the watch site Holdenkey that the item was unable to go to the original winning bidder, providing no further explanation. Tiffany's and Patek Philippe ended up deciding to sell the watch to Taiwanese actor and watch collector Zach Liu, the underbidder in the camel hair coat, for his final bid, plus fees, $6.2 million. If you wear them, you're an idiot. The sale capped a triumphant year for Philips, which in 2021 boasted the highest total watch sales of any auction house in history, at $209.3 million. Philips' competitors also had their best years ever, with Christie's reporting $205 million and Sotheby's $148 million, a 50% increase over the previous year and well ahead of pre-pandemic annual sales. After growing rapidly for the last 20 years or so, interest in luxury watches, as in many other collectibles, from sneakers to trading cards to wine, exploded during the pandemic, as people around the world all of a sudden had extra time to scroll through product shots on social media and eBay. And extra savings to spend. Long a niche passion, luxury watches have become de rigueur for a broader, younger crowd who, thanks to the internet, have quickly acquired specialized knowledge once limited to a small club of initiates. Yet even as demand has risen, the top watchmakers have not significantly raised their retail prices or their output, out of caution and with an eye toward long-term stability. As a result, it is virtually impossible for someone who is not an established client to walk into a luxury watch retailer and buy a hyped model new. The industry speaks informally of a 50-year waiting list for especially popular watches, such as the Rolex Daytona, the Patek Philippe Nautilus, the Audemars Piguet Royal Oak, or the Vacheron Constantine overseas. But the reality is you can't even get on the wait list, says Eric Wend, a former vice president of Christie's and founder of the Palm Beach-based high-end watch dealership Wind Vintage. Or rather, Wind Vintage. You're just not going to get it unless you're a good pre-existing customer or a celebrity, or if you're doing under-the-table payments to the retailers on the side in cash. The only other way to jump the queue, if you're desperate enough for one of those models, is to buy from a second-hand dealer or at auction. The upside to going this route is that you can find unique vintage pieces, some of which might previously have been owned by a movie star or a dictator and can connect you by the wrist to their aura. The downside is that the secondary market is rife with uncertainty. Dealers and auction houses almost never claim that their reports on condition, authenticity, and provenance are anything more than opinion. That makes it difficult to hold a dealer liable for misrepresenting the history of a watch. The secondary market can also be a lot more expensive. If you buy a hyped model from a dealer or online, you're almost certain to pay several multiples of the retail price. Auctions, by contrast, present an illusion of transparency. But watch experts say the major houses often know beforehand who is willing to bid what and rely at times on a variety of ethically dubious but hard-to-prove tactics, such as chandelier bidding, when an auctioneer pretends to see a raised paddle in the back of the room, which is a perfectly legal way of keeping the momentum going until a lot reaches its reserve price to run up bids and inflate the final price. Such market conditions have presented a dilemma for collectors who actually want to show off their popular models, knowing the message that will send to other connoisseurs. If you wear them, you're an idiot, says one collector. Either you paid five times retail, or you bought it retail and you're too stupid to have flipped it. Another reason not to wear one is to avoid attracting attention. In cities from Los Angeles to London, watch-related crimes have become particularly brazen during the pandemic. In Beverly Hills last March, in full view of the lunchtime crowd at Il Pastaio, three men in hoodies walked up to a man sitting at a patio table. One put a gun to the man's head as the other two yanked off the watch he was wearing, a flashy Richard Mille RM1103 flyback chronograph, valued at $500,000. In the ensuing scuffle with the man, a jeweler named Shay Belhassen, a round went off and wounded a woman in the leg. In Paris, meanwhile, violent watch thefts were up threefold last year, a phenomenon French police traced largely to a gang whose M.O. is to follow wearers of choice watches home and attack them. A task force was even created to combat the alarming rise. I think twice before wearing something in the subway or late at night, says William Messina, a prominent New York-based dealer, collector, and watchmaker. Messina blames the crime wave on some of the same forces behind the increased popularity of luxury watches in general. Because of celebrities, and especially YouTube, thieves are much more watch-aware, he says. For such a long time, celebrities were brand ambassadors, and they were wearing what they were being asked to wear. But I have noticed recently that many celebrities are wearing vintage pieces and collectible pieces, and pieces that they definitely went out of their way to get, says Arthur Touchot, international head of digital strategy at Philips. Touchot points to Michael Jordan's German-made A. Lange & Söhne, and Tyler, the creator's vintage yellow-gold Cartier Crash, whose dial looks like one of Salvador Dali's melted clocks. The Paul Newman. That there's a collector's market for watches at all is thanks in large part to one of the biggest celebrities of the 20th century. In or around 1969, Joanne Woodward went to Tiffany's in Manhattan to buy a $300 Rolex Daytona Cosmograph for her husband, Paul Newman. It was the first of several Rolexes she gave him. Each bore an engraving that urged the actor and racing enthusiast to exercise caution behind the wheel. On this one, she had inscribed, "Drive carefully, me." Newman wore the Cosmograph for more than a decade, treating it like the functional object that it was. In the summer of 1984, his daughter Nell hosted her boyfriend James Cox at their home. One day, while Cox was working on the family treehouse, Newman came by and asked him for the time. "I don't have a watch," said Cox. "I don't know what time it is." Newman handed him the Daytona. "If you remember to wind this, it tells pretty good time." By the mid-80s, the market for mechanical watches had tanked. Battery-powered watches, introduced by the Japanese brand Seiko, kept time more accurately at a fraction of the cost. Their widespread adoption triggered what became known as the quartz crisis. After decades of steady refinement, intricately created Swiss watches like Neumann's Rolex, which depend on pendulums and the force of gravity, became essentially obsolete. Having died as a practical tool, the mechanical watch became a statement of style and luxury. This renaissance started, naturally, in Italy. At some point in the middle of that decade, Neumann appeared on the cover of an Italian magazine wearing the Daytona Cosmograph. The discontinued model, which had never been especially popular, became colloquially known as the Paul Neumann Daytona. Now people had to have it. Vintage Paul Neumann Daytonas had been going for a couple $100 at flea markets. Now they were selling for thousands. After the watch disappeared from Neumann's wrist in photos, watch obsessives grew fixated with the idea of finding the original. The Paul Neumann, as it was dubbed, became, in the ecclesiastical parlance of watch collectors, the first Holy Grail. That watch is the reason for the collecting community, Touchot tells me over lunch in Geneva by the Phillips office. The community exists because of that one watch. Today, the top watch buyers tend to come from China, with U.S. buyers trailing not far behind. But Italians continue to exert a disproportionate influence, primarily as tastemakers. One of the world's most successful vintage watch dealers, known informally as the Big Boss, due to both his stature in the field and his frame, is the Italian-born David Parmigiani. I met Parmigiani, who is in his mid-50s, at his new boutique in Monte Carlo, where he sells both vintage watches and cars. He arrived 30 minutes late. I asked him what drives the passion for watches, if not their ability to tell time. "Sometimes I don't even set the time on the watches," he said. "If I want to look at what time it is, I can look at my iPhone." He held up his smartphone. "This is the only exact time we're going to have," he added. Parmigiani is in a philosophical mood these days as he prepares to pass the business on to his son. "I'm very impressed by the passing of time," he says, "and I think men, they cannot stop the passing of time. But watches..." He raises his wrist, flashing a vintage Audemars Piguet. "They give us the opportunity to admire it." There is perhaps no better illustration of the health of the watch business than Parmigiani's personal car collection. After our interview, the Big Boss takes me to his garage on the lower level, where, in between Italian posters for Paul Neumann racing movies, are about a dozen 1950s vehicles in mint condition, including Ferraris, Mercedes, and his favorite, a Daytona Spider. No relation to the Rolex model, but both are named for the Florida Speedway. There is a well-established kinship between petrolheads and watch geeks, and Parmigiani is, as Neumann was, a racing fanatic. It's only a portion of Parmigiani's collection. "The contemporary cars are in another place," he says, "except I actually have the Pagani here. A supercar, sometimes worth more than $1 million, because it was here for service." Gazing over the assortment, I ask Parmigiani, who has homes in several cities, whether he thinks the current boom market for vintage watches is a bubble. He doesn't believe it is, certainly not compared to fine art. In the contemporary art market, there are very, 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 very rich dealers, he says. You don't find this kind of wealth in the vintage watch market. God's timepiece. Parmigiani has witnessed the rise of watch collecting from its infancy. He estimates that he has handled millions of watches since he was 18, trawling for treasures at London's Portobello Road flea market in the 1980s. And when prices at auction began to reach eye-watering levels in recent years, Parmigiani kept on bidding. As Italian pop played in his office, he recalled one of the most memorable sales he attended. Almost 7 years ago, he took a seat in the opulent ballroom of the Four Seasons Hotel in Geneva, which hosted the Christie's Fall Watch Sale. For him, there was only one lot that truly mattered that day, a previously unknown gold Patek Philippe 2497 made in 1954 with a black military dial and a perpetual calendar, meaning it automatically takes into account leap years and months with fewer than 31 days. It would have been a remarkable watch, even if the description had ended there. But what made it practically sacred is that it had belonged to Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, who ruled for 4 decades before Marxist rebels toppled him in 1974. Rastafarians considered him the god of the black race. Here was a chance to buy God's timepiece. Christie's estimated the watch, engraved with Selassie's imperial seal, to be worth between $540,000 and $1,080,000. Parmigiani was sure he would face stiff competition, but he wasn't worried. "I knew I was going away with the watch," he tells me. Before the auction, he had searched through his portfolio of clients to find one he deemed worthy of this watch. "Finally, I found an American friend of mine. He's a very young guy, but he has a very good passion for rare things and rare watches. And he was the only one that told me, 'Okay, David, we go for it. Bye.' He didn't give me any limit." The auction started slowly, but as Selassie's 2497 approached, the room was packed, the energy palpable. Parmigiani wasn't nervous. He had an ace in the hole. After hammering in the previous lot, auctioneer Thomas Perazzi announced that the Patek Philippe had been withdrawn and attempted to move on to the following lot. The room lapsed into chaos. Parmigiani jumped out of his chair and demanded an explanation. The explanation came later that day. At the last minute, it was soon revealed, Selassie's descendants argued that the consigner of the watch was not its rightful owner and demanded its restitution. According to Christie's, Selassie had gifted the watch to an eminent African personality, which Selassie's family believed to be a reference to the former president of Sudan, Ibrahim Aboud. As the story is commonly told, the emperor gave Aboud the Patek Philippe in the 1960s to thank him for his help in mediating a truce between Ethiopia and Somalia. Some 5 decades later, Aboud's daughter Salma had consigned it to the auction house, but the Selassies disputed this account of how the watch landed in Salma Aboud's hands. Mel Tewadi, a representative from a group of Ethiopian-American activists working with the family, told me that the watch was likely one of countless objects looted from the imperial palace after the 1974 coup in which Selassie was overthrown. The watch was sequestered, and the matter went to the Geneva courts, which, after an investigation, ruled that in the absence of information proving either claim, the sale could go ahead. The watch went back on the block in May 2017. With his unlimited budget, Parmigiani bought it for $2.9 million, making it one of the most expensive watches ever sold, with one of the most colorful backstories, the hint of scandal only adding to its cachet. It would have been the event of the season had it not been eclipsed by another sale that took place in Geneva 2 days later, another black-dialed gold wristwatch that had belonged to another mid-century emperor, Bao Dai, of Vietnam. Across town at Phillips, Bach had sold Bao Dai's diamond-encrusted Rolex for $5 million, setting a new record for the most expensive Rolex ever sold at auction. The sale helped establish the myth of Auerbach. In 2002, as head of Phillips' watch department in his early 30s, the auctioneer had sold that very same watch for $235,000, then, as well, a record price for a Rolex. Soon after, the rising star, who had begun his career at Sotheby's, left for Christie's. He helped take annual watch sales at the auction house from $8 million in 2003 to $127 million in 2013, when he and the company parted ways amid a disagreement over strategy. Among other issues, Bach was hesitant to embrace the push toward online sales, a fight he has since abandoned, as evidenced by Phillips' exponentially growing list of online bidders over the last few years. When Bach returned to Phillips in 2014, restarting its defunct watch department, his approach, he has said, was to focus on quality over volume. He technically serves as a consultant under the auspices of Bach & Russo, the company he formed with his wife, Livia Russo. In 2017, the same year Bach sold the Bao Dai, the Holy Grail fell into his lap. More than 30 years after receiving it, James Cox was ready to sell the Rolex Daytona Paul Newman had given him, aware of its exalted status among aficionados. Though he and Nell broke up about a decade after the Rolex gift, they had remained close, and Cox decided to give a portion of whatever he'd earned for the watch to her charitable foundation, of which he is a board member. Through word of mouth, he was connected with Bach. "I don't know how else we could have found it," Bach says, speaking by Zoom from his office in Geneva, like ringing on every door in California and saying, "Hi, do you happen to have it? It was the Paul Newman that found us." When Bach heard Cox's story, he flew to Los Angeles to meet him and it. "During dinner, I let him get a little peek of it on my arm," Cox recalls. "He's like, 'You're wearing it?'" Bach knew he would have a chance to inspect the revered object more closely later, but that night at the restaurant, he couldn't resist. According to Cox, Bach asked to see the watch, pushed his plate out of the way, and pulled out his loupe at the table. The Rolex was in rough shape, with scrapes and water damage, and a sunburnt dial attesting to a life well lived, out in the open rather than a climate-controlled safe. If it had graced the wrist of anyone other than Paul Newman, Phillips might not even have accepted it in its condition, but since it was his, the wear and tear only added to the value. The sale was set for the evening of October 26, 2017, in New York. An hour or two before, Bach met with a collector who was so determined to own the watch that he tipped his hand. "He told me he might go as high as $4 million," Bach recalls. "I was like, wow, that is an unheard-of amount of money for a steel Rolex." I thanked him, and I bowed. A few hours later, Bach was behind the rostrum at Phillips. He scanned the crowd and saw the eager collector at the front. "Introducing the Paul Newman Daytona, lot number 8, Bach said, "without exaggeration, this is, to many here in the room, possibly the most iconic wristwatch of the 20th century. He wasted little time in kicking off the bidding. "I have a commission bid at $1 million that someone left with me earlier who..." $10 million, sir," shouted a Phillips employee managing the phones. Bach, who was facing the other way, swiveled dramatically toward the phone bank like a summer stock Hamlet. His eyes met the collector's. "He looked at me and I could read the letters WTF on his lips," Bach recalls, meaning like, "Why did you not tell me?" "The guy didn't stay in the race. He couldn't even get his arm up. No, I didn't see that coming." From that moment on, all the paddle raisers in the room were priced out. Proceeding for the most part in increments of $500,000, Bach kept the phone bidding going at an energetic clip, occasionally lapsing into Italian, French, and German, all of which he speaks with no discernible accent. After 11 minutes, the bidding had reached $15.5 million. To thunderous applause, Bach slammed his hammer. "It is history now. With fees, the anonymous buyer would fork over just under $17.8 million, beating the record for most expensive wristwatch ever sold at auction by more than $8 million. Cox was in the audience, sitting next to Nell Newman. "I think we were both somewhat in shock," he says. "From what I know about the actual bidders, the underbidder tapped out. They hit their limit. But what I've been told was that whoever actually got the watch didn't really have a limit, which meant it could have gone higher." Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Jamie Lee Curtis, the actor and advocate on living well, letting go, and learning to play the drums. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Knowing that each day I have lived wisely and loved well. What is your greatest fear? Not doing the above. What is your greatest extravagance? I am a replicant. I buy multiples of things I love. Bandolier, phone cases, anatomy clothes, fleece Birkenstocks, and fleece Merrill clogs, Armani lip balm. What is your favorite journey? Psychoanalysis. Which talent would you most like to have? I am currently taking drum lessons. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Eleanor Roosevelt. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I should have insisted on family dinners. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? February 2nd, 1999, when I realized I would die from opiate addiction. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My sobriety. Which living person do you most admire? Greta Thunberg. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Judgment. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Superiority. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Order, neatness. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My ankles. Which living person do you most despise? I try to remember that hurt people hurt people. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Far out. What is your greatest regret? Squandered time. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Christopher Guest, whose picture I saw in Rolling Stone in 1984, and I said to my friend who was sitting next to me, I'm going to marry that guy. And 8 months later, I did, 37 years ago. When and where were you happiest? When I am in a creative flow. What is your current state of mind? To thine own self be true. What is your favorite hero of fiction? Lee from East of Eden. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? A Lagerfeld rose. Where would you like to live? The Louisiana Museum of Modern Art in Denmark. But place it in the places I already live. What is your favorite occupation? Divesting. What are your favorite names? Rooney, Lulu, Ruby. What is your most marked characteristic? I hope kindness. What do you most value in your friends? Seeing and being seen. What is your most treasured possession? My Kathy Waterman child charm with Annie's and Ruby's names engraved. Who are your favorite writers? John Steinbeck, James Clavell, P.D. Eastman, Go Dog Go, Mark Nepo. Who are your heroes in real life? Bill and Lois Wilson, Deborah Hill, Dr. Bob Silkworth. What is it that you most dislike? Liars. How would you like to die? Alive. What is your motto? If not now, when? If not me, who? And that was the Proust questionnaire with Jamie Lee Curtis. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.